Good afternoon, firstly, to Barry, my fellow speaker, and to all of you, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon. I hope, first of all, that we do accept that the definition of community is in constant change. And I'm not free of nostalgia either, but I guess being a futurist, I do accept changes maybe a little easier than most, having learnt a long time ago that to make value judgments on changes early is always very, very risky, because you see some dramatic change, you think that's only bad, until you realise 5 or 6 years later it wasn't bad at all. But we are very prone to jump to value judgments very quickly when it comes to change, and to look, as we know, through rose-coloured glasses at the past. But just as a very broad opener to the term community, it's not that long ago when, in the agrarian age, which finished in Australia around about the 1860s, that virtually the vast majority of Australians lived in a rural community of one sort or another, either a rural community or a rural town. And it's interesting that this year, I understand from something I saw yesterday, will be the first year in which the world's population of around about 6.5 billion people will mostly live in urban environments. In other words, up until now, the world at large has mostly been rural. And when you think of China and India, which between them have got 2.5 billion people, you can understand why that figure is where it is. But up to the 1860s, we were too a rural community, and it was fairly easy to define community under those circumstances. The Industrial Age, of course, lasted for 100 years after that and brought us up to about the mid-1960s, and then we came to accept that a community was really an urban lifestyle, and in particular the word suburbs really only makes sense when you think of them in the industrial age. But we left that age behind, of course, in the mid-1960s, and we're now in a new age, which should last, according to my estimations, at least until the 2040s. So we're really over halfway through a new age, which is called many different things, sometimes the post-industrial age. I've called it the infotronics age, because I guess it's our lives are so influenced by both information and electronics. But whatever, it is a new age. There's at least 40, perhaps 50 years left of it before we begin yet another new age, perhaps in the late 2040s. And for want of a better term, I've always called that the age of enlightenment coming up. Not to say that we're not fairly enlightened at the present time. But what do I want to share with you over the next 25 minutes or so, before we get a really good speaker to address you? Because I'm only here as a pre-entertainer, as you understand. But I'd like to talk about just five areas. They'll be mostly statistics and trends. If you like, food for thought when we do think about the community, and more specifically, as I will touch on, the 25 to 45s, or what we call the Gen Xers. But first of all, I'll deal very briefly with our changing society at large, as I see it here in Australia. Secondly, the phenomenon of generations. I mean, a generation is roughly 20 years in length, and so we tend to live long enough these days to see quite a lot of generations coexisting, and more about that in a moment. And more particularly in that section, I want to talk about how different the Gen Xers are to the generations before and after them. I then want to talk about lifestyles, how they're changing, a little bit on income, spending and wealth, but I don't want to dwell too much on that. But there are issues in there for the community at large, of course, not the least of which is the polarisation of incomes and wealth. And finally, future communities, but that's going to be given to you more as a template than it is as a whole range of forecasts. Anyway, first of all, our changing society. And if I had a lot more time, I'd be touching on a whole raft of things that are clearly changing in our community. But some of these I am going to go on to spend just a minute or two on. But we're now living and working longer. And I stress the working longer as well, because we're more or less getting used to the fact that life expectancy is increasing, but we tend to forget that working lives are growing as well. And to think that we've had the definition of retirement at 65 for men around virtually unchanged for 30 years, it's a bit absurd. And to think that people are going to retire at 65 in the future and go nuts planting roses or playing golf is ridiculous. More about that in a moment. There are more generations coexisting, and that's very, very important. We've got a slowly rising divorce rate, but that hasn't been rising, as you know, for the last 30 years, but it will probably start to rise a little from here on in. But there's a whole host of things which we could talk about to remind us about how dramatic our lives and our societies and our communities are changing. And I might quickly add too that you can have all of my slides off the website rather than take notes if you'd like anyway, so you don't have to furiously take notes. But let me touch on some of these that I think are important. This is my favourite chart, particularly for a man of my age, because living longer, I keep this beside my bed every night. But it just reminds us that life expectancy was pretty short and brutal back in the early 1800s, when life expectancy was 38 years of age, virtually identical for women and men at that stage. These days, there's a 7-year gap between the life expectancy of a woman and a man. But 38 was pretty short, and I've often explained that really explains very quickly why there was no divorce in those days. There wasn't time. Because if you got married at 18, after 20 years, you might have been wondering if it was working out or not. Too late, you carked it and went to God. And now with women living to 84, there's time for one or two marriages, and it's usually them that do the trading in. And that's only fair. We ran the joint for 11,000 years, it's their turn. And yet many people do see out their golden wedding anniversary, as my parents did, and it's really a fabulous thing to see. Dad died not shortly after that. We are, however, living longer, and therefore the retirement age is rising. And really, I think we are going to start to expect to see true retirements beginning around about 75 in the not-too-distant future. That doesn't mean they're working full-time after 65 at all, but part-time doing something, because that keeps the yin-yang balance between life and leisure and work in much better balance than retiring and then working out. I mean, could you imagine being retired for 30 years? Just doesn't make sense, does it? And also, thank God, we've got time for rising formal education. And, of course, the proportion of children these days that go on to finish high school and university is now in stark contrast to the industrial age. Our age distribution, this is another favourite chart of mine because it shows that my age group is certainly increasing along with a greater life expectancy. The number of young are falling proportionally because we now know what causes children and therefore we can stop it. Or we just decide to have fewer of them, of course, as we understand. The average age, incidentally, back around about the 1860s, the average age of Australians was 22 years of age, and that's about 145 years ago. Now the average age is up around about 36, 37, heading for something like about 43 years of age will be the average age of an Australian within the next 35 years. The age group is following a not dissimilar trend, in that we are starting to see the increase in the proportion of people over the age of 65. In other words, having that fixed definition of 65, as I say, just doesn't make sense in the life of longer life expectancy. And we have to ask the question these days, what is old? And I just make the obvious point that at the age of 65, in 1800, you'd been dead for 27 years. In 1900, you were dead 12 years before that. And in the year 2000, you'll have 12 to 15 years to go at least. And in the year 2100, you'll only be halfway through your life, possibly. And Barry was reminding me before we came up to the stage, I think you said almost half of the girls born after 2001 will live beyond 100, I think was Barry's statistic, which is quite exciting. And I mean, I think the spare parts factory is going to be pretty busy at that stage, of course, too, but at least we'll get there. So I just make the point out of all this, we have to be very careful about what the word ageing really means, because we have to keep lifting the definition of what old is. Now, marriages and divorces. Now, interestingly, the average length of a marriage has never, ever changed in the last 200 years. It's always been roughly 20 years, much the same as a generational life. Hence my comment about there wasn't time for more than one marriage back in the olden days. But the divorce rate, as you can see, has moved up quite significantly during this industrial age, but it's virtually stood still, really, for the last 30 years. There's been no increase in the divorce rate in the last 30 years. And if it's going to move up, I think it's going to move up very, very slowly. So I think some of the dire predictions that we're all going to start trading in our partners more frequently, I think is an exaggeration. The marriage rate is dropping, but that's partly because people decide to get married much later. And many of you parents who've still got 35 to 40-year-olds at home will understand what I mean. They just won't go. So part of that marriage rate is because they're leaving their marriage much later in life. someone deciding to partner up without necessarily signing the piece of paper. And there are a few that are deciding that having a single life isn't all that bad. But that's also showing signs of changing, and I don't think that marriage rate is going to drop much further. In fact, it might even turn up a little bit more as we move through and towards the middle of this century. But again, facts ruin a good story. It's not as if we've given up marriage totally because it's bottoming out, and it's not as if we're going to divorce at the drop of a hat. We're not doing that either. Housing density is a reminder, though, that communities run the risk of becoming a little more lonely, because this shows the number of people per dwelling. And here's the number of people per dwelling here. And back in the turn of the last century, there was over five people for the average home, five. Now the average is half that, about 2.5. And we're heading down to where the country with the lowest density is going to be matched by us. Denmark's got the lowest density of any country in the world today. There are 2.2 people per dwelling on average. We're down to about just 2.5, but we're heading for 2.2. Now that in a sense shows up more in the next chart, where we look at the composition of households. And if I was to start at the bottom of this chart, the number of households that have got six or more in them, like mum, dad and four children, it has now diminished almost to insignificance. And yet I came from a family of eight, mum, dad and six children. But we're now a rarity, that sort of a household. Up here, it can be somewhat disturbing on first sight to think about the number of people that are living alone. Now, that could be a student going to university and just flatting by him or herself. It could be somebody after a recent divorce, licking their wounds. It could be a single girl, single working girl, single working guy. And, of course, a lot of widows and widowers up there as well. But it reminds us that there are a very, very significant number of households in Australia with just the one person in them. And that really throws out a challenge for community, whatever sense we want to use of that word. Mind you, if you've got two people in the size of homes we've got these days, they need a mobile phone to touch base with each other anyway. And often it's not one of those are out of the home. So you could almost say that, you know, there's half the households of Australia at least these days for which the most common occupant is one, you know, because the fact that they're both there is not all that often. So that could spell loneliness if we weren't careful. But are we becoming more isolated? Well, I suggest that that's not necessarily so. Due first of all to the internet, and they've now made that reasonably idiot-proof, so even I can use it, and older people than me can use it too. But the combination of the internet, mobiles, and out-of-home diversions, because if there's anything that's grown phenomenally in this new age, it is the number of things we can do outside the home. There wasn't a lot when I was growing up, except the pictures and maybe a dance or something like that. But now if you look at the number of alternatives for what you might call amusement or entertainment or togetherness or some community involvement, it's phenomenal. So I think the combination of all those things is coming to the aid of what might otherwise be the isolated and the lonely. But, of course, communities are becoming less neighbourhood-oriented with many different tribal relationships spread across vast distances, some of them being virtual communities, and that's, in a sense, what we mean by the internet. My own personal trainer, otherwise bits would be falling off even faster than they are, his main community would be on the internet. He's a guy of about 36. With a gorgeous wife, but being a personal trainer, you've often got big gaps during the day, and he jumps on the internet and plays games with people from Sweden, the United States, etc. And he's classical of what I might call a virtual community. And he has a ball with all of that. Perhaps just to remind us of the different sorts of tribes we've got these days, I just took my own tribe, for example, Phil Riven's tribe, if you like, and I've got my immediate relatives. My mother's still alive at 92. She lives up in the New South Wales Central Coast, and I'm Melbourne-based. My siblings are either on the Central Coast also or in Sydney. My sons are in Melbourne, and two of them are in Los Angeles. I had three sons. My grandchildren are in Melbourne and the United States. My partner of 12 years, Deborah, lives in Sydney. We've been commuting for 12 years. All the girlfriends are jealous, apparently, because she only sees me on weekends. And whatever. But my immediate relatives are scattered. My close mates are scattered too. If I was to nominate my three closest male mates, one's in Adelaide, one's in Melbourne, and one's in Sydney. And yet once upon a time, you would have said, oh, well, they're all somewhere in Melbourne, but they're not. The neighbourhood. Well, my neighbourhood is my apartment block. I don't know anybody either side of them, but I only know half of them in the apartment block. And my favourite shops would be part of my neighbourhood, restaurants, and the parks, as I live in East Melbourne, so we've got, you know, some of the most, two of the most glorious parks in Melbourne. My clubs, I've got one in Melbourne and I've got one in Sydney. Work, my workmates are in Australia, and because we're an international firm, they're in the United States, Indonesia, China, and the year after they'll be in Europe as well. So I've got a very wide, and that's not unusual these days. And charities and not-for-profits, well, I'm on three of those, but they are all in Melbourne. Just to remind us of how diverse a community structure can be. That takes me to generations and the differences within them. Now, this first chart shows us all the generations that have been born in Australia since 1850. And there's different colours there, which I'll come back to in a moment, because two Americans called Strauss and Howe wrote a book called Generations in 1991, where they had identified that there are only four types of generations which just keep rotating one after another. And they went back to the time of Washington to do that research. We repeated that research here in Australia and agreed with their findings that there are four types of generations. And that's going to become important when I start talking about the Gen Xers in a moment, and also an issue that's often on the minds of many of us interested in the community, and that is where to now for reform and progress. I might have a few surprising things to say about that. But these are the generations. You can see most generations produce more in numbers than the previous, and not altogether surprising. The latest generation, I call them millennials because they were born after 2001. The Americans actually referred to the millennials as those born 20 years earlier. In other words, they came to adulthood in the beginning of this new millennium, but I simply use the term millennium. And we've only got a few of those at this stage. That's the Bureau of Statistics forecast of how many there'll be by the time they run out of puff in 2021, or more particularly the parents who are giving birth to them run out of puff. I mentioned there are four types of generations, and one's always got to be very, very careful when you generalise about anything. And I guess we accept the limitations of that. But insofar as you can find some generalised behavioural patterns and mindsets of generations, the civics are one generation, and they're coloured in yellow as they were in the previous chart. They're the sort of what you call the wealth creators and the nation-building type generation. Some might say the classic Protestant work ethic as well. They're a can-do type generation. They're pragmatic, they're rationalists, but not a lot of social graces. They've got difficulty spelling the word opera. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean. So they're very much a hard-driving, wealth-creating group. They're the ones coming through today, incidentally, called the Net Generation or Generation Y. Then you've got the adaptives, which happens to be my generation, way, way back. And they're a much more silent generation. They're a much more obedient generation, but they're a much more socially aware generation than the civics ever tend to be. They adapt wealth building. They're not game to give up wealth building completely because their parents would kill them. But they like to adapt wealth building to other social needs. So my generation, which was born up until 1943, were very much that sort of a generation. But they do develop scruples. I mean, we became, not just because of the church, but because of your parents. You thought, oh, if you're not driving yourself hard, then somehow you're letting your parents down. Then come the idealists. Now, why do the idealists come third? Well, firstly, because these two people, these two generations, create so much wealth, they always create full employment. There's no such thing as unemployment with the civics and the adaptives. So the idealist generation are born into full employment, no monetary worries, and so what are they going to do? Well, money's not the issue for them. For the idealists, it's how you can reform society and all of its ills. And they have their ears pinned back and away they go. Now, the most recent, of course, idealists, you wouldn't have to be too clever to guess, have been the baby boomers. More about them in a moment. But the previous one, 80 years before the baby boomers, was way back in the time of the 1880s, which led up to the massive reforms which we saw around about the turn of the century as that mob of idealists came to power, because they created federation, they created free and compulsory education up to 15, they brought in the vote for the women. So these sort of reformist generations come through about every 80 years, every fourth generation, but the most recent have been the baby boomers. And they are the social visionary and idealistic type generation. They want to change the world, not eventually, but now. And they're humanists, they're social re-engineers, but they're also big spenders. You can't give them a checkbook, not in government, not anywhere. Then finally, you've got the reactives, and by their very term, they're reacting against the reformist zeal of their parents. And the most prominent example of that these days, of course, is the Gen Xers. in a sense, they ran into reform fatigue. I mean, you hear the term reform fatigue used about economic reforms, but you can get social reform fatigue as well. And the Gen Xers ran into that. And I suppose one of the call signs of the Gen Xer is whatever. You know, and you feel like slapping them across the face. Well, when you're allowed to, but you can't now. And that almost describes the Gen Xers saying, yeah, whatever. Does it matter all that much, Mum or Dad, you know, et cetera? And of course, it drives their parents mad. Where's the reformist zeal that I had? You know, I was out there carrying cards and everything. So they're a much more reactive, conciliatory generation. They consolidate the changes that their idealist parents brought in. But they're peace seekers, and they also repair the damages of the idealists, because as much as the idealists thank God for them, because they bring in much overdue reforms on everything, they also leave a trail of damage to be cleaned up. And for example, you'd have to thank the baby boomers for tackling the Aboriginal problem, but not thank them for the way they did it, because arguably they're worse off now than they were, you know, 40 years ago. In other words, the cures were worse than the complaint. So that you'll find it's these sort of reactives, or in this case the Gen Xers, that are going back to saying maybe we should rethink not the fact that there's a problem, but how we might fix it, because we haven't fixed it in the last 30 or 40 years. So they're very quiet, they're a quiet achiever generation. How many generations have we got alive today? Well, six of them, which is a hell of a lot of it. If I was to show that in pictorial form, in the year 2006, these are the generations that are alive today. And I'm interested to say it's a sign that I have got a relative in every one of those six generations. My mother's up here as one of the older civics, if you like, and I'm one of the adaptives. Most of my siblings, my sisters and brothers, are idealists. My children are all reactives. They're all in that age group. Four of my grandchildren are the new civics, and they'd scare a dog off a chain, I can tell you. Because they're real goers. And I've got a two-year-old granddaughter as well, who's one of the new adaptives. So I've got a leg in every one of those camps. Now, if I was to take that out to the year 2016, which is only 10 years away, the only point I want to make here is that the power in the community is shifting from the idealists, which brought in all those reforms back in the 60s, 70s and 80s, and the power is shifting to this quieter generation, the Gen Xers, and into the hands of the civics, who, as I say, would scare a dog off a chain, because they're the great wealth creators coming through. And, of course, once we get back to full employment, like we pretty well are now at under 5%, it might hover up again a bit above 5% for another year. Once you get below 5%, it won't go back up again for about 20 to 25 years. We've got full employment coming up for at least two or three decades, which is very, very exciting. And I think good for community, if we've used that expression as well. Now, we do tend to give names to some of these people. I mean, the baby boomers were certainly given the most attention of any generation, probably in my lifetime. Mind you, my generation was often called the Depression generation, because most of us, not me, but most of my generation was born during the Depression. They're the baby boomers. The Gen Xers, or the reactives, this group here, my mate used to call the Angoras when they were early in the piece, meaning that they're lovely, cuddly and useless. But he's since withdrawn that definition because they didn't say very much, he didn't think they were very bright, forgetting, of course, they couldn't get a word in edgeways with their parents. So that term's been fully now recanted upon, and he's got an enormous respect, as I have too, for the Gen Xers. I used to call these the ferals, actually, the civics, and not because they're wild animals, but because they're the first generation in history, if you like, the next generation or Generation Y, to be totally unconstrained by time, space and distance. You see, with the internet and mobiles, there is no constraint over distance. Geography is not a constraint. I use the term free rangers for them these days. Now, there is changing attitudes coming through as a result of these generations, of course. The Generation Xers, the ones that are featured in our title today that Barry and I are talking about, as I say, are reactives. They're reacting against reform zeal. The good news for those of you who have reformist zeal in this audience is that it's going to come back again in another 60 years' time. So in the meantime, we're going to have to clean up the reforms that we've started and titivate around the edges and make them work. But we're not going to find it very easy to start new causes over the next 40 or 50, 60 years. But they're reactives, they're a quiet generation. In a sense, they're reacting against the reform zeal of their baby boomer parents. They have a much more balanced attitude to family and work, though, and that's one of the great legacies being created or left behind by the Gen Xers, that getting a family work balance is really very high on their agenda. They're not overly ambitious, although quite a number of really outstanding entrepreneurs have emerged already out of that generation, but they largely settle for the quiet life. The one coming after them, the next generation, who are 25 down to 4 years of age, they're the new civics, and they're a driving, goal-oriented generation. They have a true we approach to life and business. They're the best educated and savvy generation in history, and they're fearless. And those of you who've got children in that age group will know what I mean. Now, when you look at the generations, though, in the workforce today, because bearing in mind you tend not to work up until the age of 15 at least, and often later than that after you're still at university, but you can see that the Gen Xers now account for almost half the total workforce. Now, the thing about that is that when it comes to the way they work, they're pioneering a totally new way of working, and they prefer to work on the basis of being paid by outputs, not inputs. Now, the difference of that is that my generation, all the earlier ones, were paid on inputs. Turn up at 9, leave at, you know, at 5:30, and you're a good worker. The Gen Xers would turn up their nose at that idea. What on earth has ours got to do with it, which is inputs? It's the results of the work. In other words, what do you want me to achieve and pay me accordingly, and we'll call it quits, if you like, a contractual arrangement. They're not going to work on inputs because, you see, the very term employee carries with it the last vestige of the word slavery. The only difference being that a modern employee is allowed to go home at night and we feed them and give them money, which you didn't give to the serfs. But if you look at the evolution of work, you know, we started with slaves, that's gone, damn it. Anybody think I'm an employer, but I'm joking about that. But we moved from slaves to serfs to indentured apprentices, which was close to slavery in a way, but they're being trained, and onto the word employee, but it still had a vestige left of it of slavery. The idea of the future is that the employee term will be gone by the second half of this century, and you look back at the word employee as if it was a serf or an indentured apprentice, and somebody says, "Were you an employee, Grandad?" My God. In other words, the whole workforce is going to become their own business and contract to somebody for something over X number of years and be paid on the results. The same as any other businesses. You don't pay for something unless you dish it up to what the consumer expected. Now, that's very hard for the baby boomers. The people resisting that change are these groups here. These wonder what all the fuss is about, and these won't even know why the fuss started. In other words, I feel sorry in a sense for the Labor Party at the moment because fighting the concept of contractualism, is really like trying to drag yourself back to the past and tell these generations that they're off on the wrong track. It just absolutely floors me, and I'm sorry, and it's the only political thing I make. But when I look at it and the evolution of what's happening, particularly with the Gen Xers and the next generation, they want to be their own boss. Now, my business, I've got about 120 employees, I suppose, scattered around the world. But any of them that thought that they should turn up at a certain time and finish it at a time would be crazy. They just don't think that way. We don't care if they take a day off because their wife's sick or they want to go shopping or they want to get their hair done. I don't care. We don't care. Couldn't care less. As long as, you know, if it's an emergency, we can reach them on a mobile. And as long as they get the work done that they've agreed to do by the end of the week or the end of the month. It's a contractual arrangement. We provide as much freedom as we possibly can. Barry may want to talk about how Google operate too in that sense. But we are seeing a radical change in the work community. You know, I've talked about social community. That's the work community. There's big, big changes. I should move on very quickly if I can, though, from here on in. Income, spending and wealth. I'll be very quick on this. It might amaze you to find out that this year, the average household income in December this year will be almost $102,000. And you can almost hear in the sucking of breath. And particularly with blokes, because they think they're the only ones working in the household, you know. But they forget to add in the fact that they've got their wife and their two 40-year-old children still at home, of course, or whatever. But it might stagger you to find that's going to be the average income. And it really is quite staggering. How do we spend it? Well, easily. but the most important point I'd make here about this chart, and you can always look at this on the website if you want later on, but the most important part about this chart is that the amount of our total income that we spend on goods, like cars and TVs and clothing and food and newspapers and all the stuff you can touch, the physical goods, or the things you buy at a retail outlet, is less now than 30% of all of our spending. All the rest of it is services, including taxes, which come back to us as a service, like free education or health or whatever. In other words, we are very much a services-oriented society, which is one of the reasons why we tend not to have recessions these days. It's only one of the reasons. Because, you know, when things used to get a bit fearful, you'd stop buying goods. Say, oh, we'll put off, you know, buying that and buying that and buying that. But you're not going to put off paying your education or your electricity or your telephone or all the rest of it. And the other reason why we tend... In fact, we never have a recession because of consumer spending. It never goes negative anyway, thanks to women. And and that's true. I mean, men are the most fearful spenders around. Look, things do get tough from time to time, and I've been through a number of recessions or near recessions, and you know, I'd sit down with my wife and we'd say, oh, look, now's not the time to go out and get that new washing machine. I know it's sort of looking a bit wonky, but we would like it. But you don't. So you make a pact just to back off for 6 months and see how the economy's going. That lasts long enough until the washing machine breaks down. And, of course, who stays home waiting for the tradesman who might arrive between 6 in the morning and 6 at night, but you never know when. So she's the one that loses the day's pay. And so it gets fixed. And, of course, 4 weeks later it breaks down again. So she does what any sensible human being would do. She replaces it with a brand new one. Now, the husband doesn't notice that for at least 4 days because it's the laundry's secret women's business, according to most men. But she leaves the door open one day and he walks past on Thursday. He says, hey, hang on, sweet. I thought we agreed now was not the time to spend it. She says, by the time you were ready, sweetheart, we'd be all dead. Now, he does what any normal husband does, and that is he sulks until Saturday. Then he goes out and buys a new car. And the following Wednesday, they get the plasma screen that Anne's got next door that she's always wanted. And before you know where you are, the recession's averted. So recessions only occur because of men, because men are in charge of capital expenditure, like building new factories and offices and restaurants and hotels, and they get nerves as all hell. Women don't. Women are fearless. And we don't have too many recessions anymore, partly because we're a services society, and secondly because the women have now got some power, thank God, after 11,000 years. Okay, very quickly, and I'm using up time here, thank you. Our assets, where do we store our assets? Mostly in housing, but that's changing. And the fastest growing form of wealth in Australia is in our superannuation, thank very much to Mr Keating in 1993. And we're now starting to invest much more here, and for fairly good reasons too. First of all, the return you get from your money in super averages 11% return a year. The profit you make from owning your own house is about 4.5% a year. Your house actually gains in value on average about 8.5% to 9% a year, but you've got another 4% off that for wages and maintenance, and for rates and maintenance and all the rest of it. So you make about a 4.5% return on housing, you make 11% on super, you make 13% on shares, and with a more savvy, financially oriented younger generation coming through, property will be way, way less than half of our assets in the not too distant future. We are all surely concerned by the polarisation, though, of incomes and wealth. I won't dwell on that. We know it. It's why there... And if anything is disrupting the community and remains a perennial challenge, it's how do you pick up the disadvantage down here and lift them up to these levels up there? It's not the way Lang Hancock said you could fix it. That is, you know, the best way to help the poor is not to join them, which was probably one of the toughest comments ever made. This chart simply reminds that when it comes to the income distribution, the wealth, we've got an enormous amount of work still left in Australia. And I would think most of you are involved in an organisation that's tackling that income problem or wealth distribution problem, but also many other social challenges as well. My own charity, Open Family, is one that's challenging not those without money, but those almost without a family or part of a dysfunctional family. But incomes are one of the challenges. Quickly, lifestyles. In the interest of time, I won't dwell on this, but I've got two charts that simply try to summarise what life was like in the so-called good old days up to 1965, what we call the industrial age. Things like home ownership and the quarter-acre block. Dad went to work, but Mum stayed at home. Even in the early 1960s, only about 8% of married women went out to work. Today it's 58%. There were long careers for men with a gold watch at the end of it. There were very strict rules about sex, blasphemy and other stuff. All gone. We only went shopping on high streets. There was no such thing as shopping centres in those days. Everything was do-it-yourself in and around the home. Our entertainment was the corner pub, the sports field and church, and the midday roast on Sundays. In other words, you look at that and you think, oh my God, was that really life? Well, yes, it was, so shut your face. For anybody that's, you know, half my age, okay? These days, it's very, I'm not allowed to swear, sorry, okay. These days, yes, home ownership is still dominant, but leasing's very much on the rise, particularly in Sydney, where you live out in the Blue Mountains and spend 4 hours travelling to and from work, or you live in the city and lease at half the price. Yes, Dad and Mum are both work these days with 1 to 3 kids, and nobody knows where they are, and that's why you've got mobiles. Yes, there are many more marriages now due to the longer life expectancy, which I mentioned earlier. We've got the internet, sport all the time, both watching it on TV, etc. And to look at that is to remind us how life has changed. Even this word electronic guardian angels, we've now got, we always got 2 guardian angels. My mum said that when I was a youngster, and I could never find them. But we have got like guardian angels these days. They're either in our ears, helping us to hear if we're deaf. They're a heart pacemaker, that's an electronic guardian angel. We've got ABS brakes on our cars to stop us getting into the car in front, et cetera, et cetera. We've got them everywhere. Okay. We are now handing out a lot more work we used to do ourselves. This shows the split of actual hours of work by men and women. The hours of work are the same for both. I'll show you that ruins another great story, but these are Bureau of Stats figures. But the men spend more time at paid work, and the women have, at this stage, because of child-rearing, more in unpaid work. But we're outsourcing stuff, particularly for 2 income-earning families. And this is the amount of outsourcing we do today that we used to do ourselves just 40 years ago. And this year, something approaching $260 a week is being spent by the average family getting somebody else to do things they used to do themselves, like entertainment, instead of playing bridge at home or whatever. Tourism, of course, instead of staying with friends and relatives, you now pay for the privilege. We're eating out a lot more, which is why kitchens are slowly disintegrating, not being used. We get financial advice, we've got legal advice, we've got health, which we outsource instead of mum trying to fix you up. There's even one of the oldest professions still being outsourced. In fact, we spend $1.7 billion on that. And the amount we spend on churches is only $650 million, less than half. And I said that to one of my close mates in Melbourne who's a priest. He said, oh, I think it's probably always been that true, way for 100 years or more. But we do an enormous amount of outsourcing, that's the main point. And that's what's creating more and more leisure time, as you can see on this chart. And people say, where's all that so-called leisure age we're entering? Well, I've got to tell you, we are continuing the pattern of creating more and more leisure time, mainly through outsourcing of things we used to do at home. And never feel guilty about outsourcing. I've said for many, many years, sloth is one of the most underrated virtues in the community. Because through sloth, you are helping create more jobs for other people by outsourcing it. That's why we've got jobs in lawn mowing, in car washing, in restaurants, in fast food outlets. You must always feel virtuous through sloth. And so we are entering a much more leisure-oriented society. I've talked too long. I had a couple of more slides, but you can look at those at your own leisure. Many thanks for listening.